kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to episode number 97 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide podcast by me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Belshaw. Di, you say this is episode 97, but I feel like we've already recorded episode 97.
We actually have. It's true. So episode 97 was recorded last week, but we had some technical difficulties.
Yeah, so we had some technical difficulties with Zencastr, which is what we've gone back to now that they've written a blog post about how they've fixed the audio drift problem that we were talking about with Chrome 64. And I'm doing this on my new Chromebox, and it's all working fine, and Di's using Chrome. But we were paying for something called Cast. It's TriCast with a dot before the ST. It's TriCast dot, yeah, ST. And we're paying for that, and it just didn't record my side of the audio after about 2 minutes.
Yeah, that's a bit weird, isn't it? So there was an error, I remember, when your audio was uploading, and mine went up fine. But you said there was an error, I remember, last week, but it seemed to go through okay, and then it didn't live up to...
Right, and then I offered to download the audio, but then that file was corrupted. Whereas now, Zencastr, it looks like they've rewritten it from the ground up. And I don't know if you noticed that they've got a health check on it. So when you connect it...
Yes, there was that. I noticed that on the way through. That was so hopefully it should be good. We'll see what happens. Anyway, enough about the tech. Let's talk about the tech. How was your week?
indeed. There's no reason why you would have seen this, Di. You'll be head down teaching, but I've started microcasting.
No, I have noticed microcasting going on. I only like the first one, episode 000, to be honest, because it had Ben and Grace on it.
Yeah, so just to say, I noticed a few people doing this. So Adam Proctor, Aaron Davis, and some other people. So I asked Adam what he'd use. He's an iPhone and Mac user. But he mentioned that he was using a PowerPress plugin, which I talk about on the thing. But I had to set it up, and I had to have like a reference point. So I made Microcast episode 000. And my kids are on there. And the reason why Ben's on there is because he made the introduction using Music Maker Jam, and Grace just wanted to say hello, basically.
All right. Well, it's very sweet. I enjoyed hearing them. Cool. Well, that's a nice idea. Let's talk about it as a wider thing. So microcasts, what are you using them for? So let's describe what microcasts are first. So they're just short, 5 minute, maybe less than that, little clips of audio, essentially.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be like less than 10 minutes. And it's usually just one person, although I guess if you were at a conference, you might want a little interview or whatever, with links, just talking about what you're up to and what you're doing. So... I link in one of the microcasts. Let me just get the link there to Adam Proctor's is called Fragmentum, and Aaron Davis's is part of his wider kind of blog, just as mine is now part of my wider Thought Shrapnel blog. But yeah, the idea is just to talk about the stuff I'm doing, because sometimes I don't want to write a blog post, because blog posts have to have a bit more structure than rambling, you know, the kind of stuff we do on this podcast as well. So what have I talked about? Well, I've talked about setting it up. I've talked about what I'm working on this week. I've talked about some technologies we're using with Project MoodleNet. And then today, while I was walking in the woods, I want to do this blog post with DML Central around how I think the skills gap is kind of bollocks, but I wanted to talk through it. And I actually did a practice one of this and then recorded the actual microcast 4 where I talk about how the skills gap is a made-up thing.
Cool. So they're available on the Thought Shrapnel blog, should you wish to go and have a look.
Yeah, that's right. So I really like it as an idea. I think it's a good one.
Well, I think it does have mileage. I've seen different iterations of it in the past, short of audio notes, and we've tried the things with short audio conversations as well, you know, where you're pinging notes backwards and forwards. I think it's a good idea, and I think audio is finding its feet, and but I think it's sort of changing the way that it's communicating information around the world, and it's a good way to do it. It's certainly nice to hear you and hear Adam and hear Aaron as well.
So the difference, I guess, with Adam is that Adam specifically, so PowerPress has this built-in feature where you can submit it to Apple Podcasts, Android Overcast, RSS, all that kind of stuff. Right. And he's got a separate site for Fragmentum. You know, he's looking for it to be a separate thing. Whereas other people like Aaron Davis and myself, it's part of a wider kind of blog, I guess. So yeah, I'm not subscribed to podcast directories. I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I think it's about it being in the flow with another set of information, isn't it? So if you think about what you're communicating and who your audience to and what purpose it's serving, then for Adam, he's clearly putting that out as a podcast of sorts, just him by himself, but short podcast episodes, which I'm sure don't interest Tide listeners at all because they're like marathon runners. But having it as part of the feed of your output is kind of cool. But if you do it on a separate location and you put it out with your feed anyway, but people can subscribe to the microcast just by themselves because that's their thing, then that's not a bad thing necessarily. Do you know what I mean?
No, I think so. And so I'm wondering whether there's a plugin for WordPress which allows you to create a feed from each category. And so maybe just creating a category RSS feed that people can manually add to a podcast client. I'm not really sure that I want it to be a podcast that appears in like iTunes and you can subscribe to. That would feel a bit weird. It needs to be part of the flow, but whatever.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, absolutely. I think so Apple people are Apple people. I remember someone, it was a podcast the other day. I can't remember whose it was. And I was going to go and listen to it and just said iTunes. And so I thought, I don't do iTunes. I'll see you later.
Yeah. I was interested in the workflow, and obviously Adam's using all Mac tools and everything. All I'm using is the built-in recorder on Android, and then I was using Audacity on my Linux laptop, and then I thought surely there must be a way of doing this just on the web, so I can do it on the Chromebox I've now got in my office. And I looked around quite a lot, and I was getting frustrated, but then I came across one called Audio Joiner. And so all this does is it's a really kind of slick tool. I'll just put it in here. Audio Joiner allows you to connect together several bits of audio, and it does cross-fading automatically, and you can just see the waveform and crop bits off the start and the end. So that's all I'm doing. So I can record a couple of bits of speech and then add Ben's little intro-outro and then just get the download MP3, upload it to WordPress, and off I go.
Ba-ba-boom.
Yeah.
Anyway. Cool. I like the idea. I think there's a little bit of mileage in that, really, for doing all sorts of things, I think. You know?
Yeah, it'd be nice if I could do it entirely on my phone. I just haven't found a way of doing that yet.
All right, okay. No, I'd want that, I think. But so I can imagine, I could do that from a digital strategy point of view, from barefooting point of view, from a computer science teaching point of view. I could do it from any of them or all of them. It could just be my thing, whatever I want to talk about.
I think it's worth saying, because we're having a conversation on Mastodon about this. I think it's worth saying, because Wayne Gibbons, hi Wayne, if you're listening, he was saying, well, how should I get started? Free is a good price point for me at the moment, etc. And I was talking about self-hosting your data, which is obviously something I always want to do. But I think if you don't care so much about that, from what I read in terms of that discussion, you can use anchor.fm on your mobile. And then if you go to the desktop web version of that, then you can download what you've recorded. So anchor.fm might be a good example for just doing entirely on your phone.
Yeah, you could do SoundCloud as well, maybe. SoundCloud records on the...
Can you record straight into the SoundCloud app?
You can, yeah. Oh, I think so. Don't quote me. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure you can, to be honest, but don't quote me on that.
Okay. I'll just put the link into Anchor FM in the show notes there. Cool. So what have you been up to this week, Di?
I can't remember. It's like 2 weeks now, if not longer, because last time we spoke, we hadn't spoken for a long time anyway. Is that right?
That's right. Let's just think. I was in Australia, then America, and then it was the end of the next week, which was last week, was the snow.
Oh, okay, there's been some snow. I have thrown a couple of snowballs. We had quite good snow here. I played football in the snow as it was falling for the first time a week ago, 8 days ago, 9 days ago, Monday. And that was beautiful, under the lights with the snow falling. That's great. Then what did I do? So then the snow came. My colleague who teaches in my department had a couple of days off because he couldn't make it into work. So I had more lessons to teach, which was really good fun. And... But being in a boarding school, you know, you have some issues to do with snowball fighting, possibly, and the like. But other than that, everyone can get to work pretty much on time, so it doesn't affect the school that much, other than a little bit of uniform adjustment and that kind of thing.
Well, I tell you what, I saw there was something going around, and I watched the clip on Good Morning Britain or whatever it's called, and there was a head teacher who had banned kids from touching snow in case they threw snowballs.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I was like, hang on a minute. And then I was talking to Brian Mathers. Hi, Brian, if you're listening. And he was saying, yeah, but his wife teaches in an inner city London school. And, it's different in the city because there's grit around and stuff. And if that gets in a snowball, we're talking serious issues.
Oh, no, I definitely had that before. I've had it as myself. I've had snowballs thrown at me with stones in them when I was a kid up in Newcastle. Sure. Not in the city, though. That was just done deliberately by people who I called friends. So that is true, is that, you know, there could be things in the snow that could damage people's faces and things like that. And it is also true that some people get a little bit too aggressive in that situation where they're allowed to fight all of a sudden. And it's sort of a thing, and people take it too far. I mean, things are always going to go wrong and happen. I think for a head teacher, isn't that the difficulty of being a leader in that way? You know, you have to make these calls. You have to make a decision on whether you're going to, whether you're going to just sort of say, look, everyone, you know what the right thing to do is. Can you just try and do the right thing, please? Or don't use the word just, but.
Yeah,
you know.
Difficult with a primary school. And it was interesting because my daughter is quite tough usually, but she was just like, oh, no, no snowballs, stop it, and start crying and everything like that. But love sledging. Sledging was great. And it was that. It was interesting. You know, I remember reading something about Inuit having lots of different words for snow.
50. And, that's Kate Bush would tell you.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was interesting seeing the different types of snow over the course of 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, I was quite taken by what we don't normally see, which is the snow blowing off the snow. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it wasn't snowing, but the wind was going across the snow and it was lifting bits off the surface and blowing it along. You get these swirling patterns. That was quite beautiful.
There were, you'll remember where Clifton is. So on the way out of Morpeth onto the A1, there were 10-foot snowdrifts.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! My cousin lives up west of Newcastle in the country, and he sent me some pictures, which were really, really nice to see. But big snow.
It's certainly the worst or the best snow I've ever seen. You know, my dad used to say, "Oh, when he was a lad, he lived on the end of terrace, and there used to be snow as high as the top of the door." And I used to think, "Bull." But obviously, he was talking about snow drifts and having to dig themselves out and all this stuff. So
yeah,
it's been like that this week. And the 6 steps over to my office were treacherous.
That's what I found being back at home, being at the school, boarding school, is I just had to walk to the office. It was all lovely. But I remember being in Norfolk as a child. I used to live there near Norwich. And I remember that my dog walking along the lane into the snow and like making his own tunnel, like you couldn't see him at all. And in the snow drifts, they were that big, but we lived out in the country near Norwich. But that was beautiful, but I never got snow like that again. That was the one time only thing of that sort of size and all that. So that was back in, that must have been about 1979, 78, something like that.
Wow, before I was born.
Yeah, man. That's the way it rolls.
I just reminded me of a book that I bought ages ago by Ranulph Fiennes called Cold, and I started reading it. And he's talking about all these journeys and adventures he's been on in like subarctic conditions. Let's see if I can put the link in here. It's just called Cold. And some of the stuff he talks about is pretty intense. And I don't know if he's written odd or had it ghostwritten or whatever, but it's he's got a good turn of phrase in there.
Okay. Well, people who do chilly things do chilly things. I mean, it's not, it's a bit weird. Anyway, so I've been doing snow. We've had all the surfaces for the teachers, Microsoft Surface Pros have arrived. So we'll be just planning out the rollout of that and the training materials and how much time I need to spend with them. And I've been teaching complicated stuff, found that quite difficult, complicated computer science stuff to do with What was it? There was one thing I couldn't get my head around in particular, which is a circle. Is it circular? Circular shift in bitwise manipulation in binary, which been doing my head in. Contact Pat Parsley, my a friend of mine through online only, and but he's a professor of computer science, and he was none the wiser. So I'd said, can you help me out with this part? I can't understand it. I got lost in class and it was a bit embarrassing. And then before he replied, I'd just gone on Wikipedia actually. And Wikipedia provided really good definitions and branches off into different places to about this, which is worth noting for any computer science teacher. And then he said, yeah, I'd just have done that. So that was kind of fine.
That's awesome.
So that's that. Have I done anything else? I've probably done some other stuff, but I can't remember what it is now.
Okay. The audio that was lost in the previous episode, we'll put the links, as I think you suggested, Di, into this week's show notes, should everything be okay this week. Just to say that, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we talked about last week about, you know, Simon Finch and what's the point of Safer Internet Day, and about creating media and just consuming it, about Firefox OS. Yeah, so.
Yeah, Amy Orban's tweets were really cool about screen time and knowing when it's too much, but also this Twitter conversation is linked in there as well, which I recommend people reading if they have, if screen time's on their mind in any way, shape or form. They were really good, I thought.
No, definitely. And let's just revisit that quickly, because I've got an update. So Amy did this wonderful thing she shared in the Slack channel and then redid a new version put on Twitter. And I shared it on Thought Shrapnel, and she asked three questions of her, I think, teenage daughter, to make sure that they're using things, screen time productively. And I think she's applying it to herself as well. So number one, are you making something cool? Two, are you learning how to make something cool? And three, are you being inspired by cool people or stuff? So are you making something cool? Are you learning how to make something cool? Are you being inspired? And so I've printed this out and put it around our house, you know, like where the tablets are charged and phones are charged and, you know, where the PlayStation is. And we've made a rule that the kids aren't allowed to play on the PlayStation apart from at weekends. They're only allowed, and Ben's only allowed, like word games on his phone. He's got mock sats next week. He's got sats later this year. And we're trying not make it too big deal, but at the same time, we all realize it's kind of important too. So he has been looking for ways, obviously, to get on screens, but he has found this YouTube channel, which I'll see if I can find. It's called like Kids Hub Art or something like that. See if I can find it quickly. Art for Kids Hub. This is it. And it's this guy with a family of four kids and his wife, and he's got this studio, and he has got like thousands of videos on how to draw stuff. And each video must be like less than 10 minutes. Art for Kids Hub. And it's seriously fantastic. So they can copy it as they go along. He's drawing at the same time as his kids are. You're looking at it from above, and he's using Sharpies, and, you know, Ben's now bought some pencils, the ones that he recommended, to color it all in and stuff. And some of the stuff he's produced is absolutely fantastic. And now he's doing it without the videos in the same style, and Greece has got involved too. So, yeah, definitely, you know, if you have these rules about, are you creating something awesome? Are you being inspired? Are you learning how to do it? Really kind of changes the game.
Yeah, no, that's a really cool idea, isn't it? Because it's just gives really easy, manageable things to go and do in short amounts of time. And it is true, you know, these devices we have, we discussed before, they're nuggets of gold, and people want to do stuff on them. So if you can direct that energy in a positive place, I think it's a really cool thing to do. It just takes the edge off all of this screen time chatter and this fear about everything, and just directs it in a really good way.
So I've been impressed, it seems more productive, and he's proud of what he's produced rather than just having played FIFA for an hour and a half or whatever. So it's good.
Well, at the other end of the spectrum to that, I attended a PSHE talk this evening. We were lucky enough to have a gentleman called Martin Daubney in school to talk to our upper six. Do you know him? If you don't recognize the name?
I haven't come across that name, no.
Well, he was the longest ever serving editor of the magazine Loaded. You know that magazine?
Reloaded.
Loaded.
Loaded magazine. Yeah, that doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No, it doesn't. And so it was under a lot of scrutiny, and he put and so he started out defending pornography because his magazine was entitled, you know, as pornography, big in the press and that kind of thing. And he stood up and said, whatever, you know, just sort of get off the world to everybody. And then he had children, and his sort of view about pornography changed enormously. So he was here to talk to our upper six about pornography. So it was a very different kind of talk, and it was more about him than it was about porn or the sort of the research he's done. But in 2013, which is 5 years ago now, he produced a film called Porn on the Brain, which I'll link to the IMDb version of in the show notes. It's a Channel 4 available thing, and Channel 4 is still making money out of it. So it keeps getting taken down from YouTube. So I've just linked the IMDb info on it there. But he gave a really interesting shot about addiction. And so they took 23 young men who thought they had, who, you know, certainly had a relationship to porn, and put them in MRI scanners and showed them porn to see what the reaction was. And if you do that, there's lots of other studies where you can use them as benchmarking about what's going on in the brain. So they looked at the brain activity, and those the specialists in medical specialists in addiction were very convinced that porn was having the same reaction as showing a picture of a syringe and a spoon to a heroin addict would have, you know, that kind of stimulation to the brain. And so they did this research, and he's just been a bit of a myth buster, which is in line with what we were talking about last week, sort of myth busting about screen time. And you have to talk about it in its complexities. And he wasn't coming out with any particular right or wrong answer. But what he did say, he was part of the committee that has put together the legislation that's coming out that under 18-year-olds or all people must be verified as over 18 before they can access any porn site. And that kicks in next month in our country. Mm. So we discussed this legislation happening, I think, last year in the summer, and so that's coming in soon in the UK. So that will be interesting to see how you can get around that. And I think they're going to do it through telephone numbers. But he interestingly said he didn't agree with it as an approach, and he referred to the Dutch model of sex education, and that they had the lowest number of teenage pregnancies, the lowest number of STDs, and the lowest something else. Oh yes, age of consent. Oh sorry, first time people were having sex, losing their virginity, the age was older across Europe. And but they start their sex education at the age of 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And obviously it's all done appropriately, and it's staggered up through the years so that the education is full and complete. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because so Holland has, I guess, a reputation for more liberal ways of introducing these things. They have laws on drugs, et cetera, very, very well known. I just thought that was a really interesting approach. And he was very much in favor of education and getting the truth in the room and talking about these things, which is not dissimilar to how we talk about the certain things that we think people need to be aware of and concerned about and cautious about, that education and talking is the best way forward. So it's worth mentioning.
It's really interesting. I mean, we talk about this kind of stuff every so often on this podcast, and it's difficult as a man to have a conversation around porn with almost anybody, to be fair. And I did see something which I didn't put in the show notes because I didn't think it was relevant to what we were talking about, but it was in the New York Times at the weekend, and it was by someone called Stoya. I guess that's her stage name. It's entitled, Can There Be Good Porn? And what she's saying, she's talking about how there's been attempts to create, you know, she's saying porn's not going anywhere, so how can we make it so that it's better? Like, and it shouldn't be a replacement for sex education, but often young men especially are getting their sexual norms from porn. So what can we do here? And she gives an example. She says there was a BDSM-focused website called Kink, which provided context for its sex scenes through a project called Behind Kink, with videos that showed the scenes being planned and performers stating their limits. Their films also showed a practice called aftercare, in which participants in an intense BDSM experience discuss what they've just done and how they're feeling about it. Mm-hmm. But then she says how what often happens is that things are ripped off paid-for sites, and then all of the stuff which isn't sex is just taken out and then uploaded to tube sites. And so even when they do try and do context stuff, it just gets ripped out and most people are accessing porn through tube sites. So
I think that's really interesting because it becomes a bit like drugs in a way. So drugs that are made illegal, and again, you go back to the Holland, the Dutch model in Holland, the different methods of belief, which, you know, if you look at sort of Colorado, California, different places in America are kind of following suit, really, with certain drugs. And but there is no way that you can get, quality approved drugs. And this is a big issue. And it's the same thing that really she's saying there is because it's being provided free, people are just accessing, for want of a better word, bad porn, porn that is bad for you. And so this guy, Martin Daubney, was saying that that the porn is like, he didn't compare it like this, it's my analogy, but like a gateway drug, really. That it just, so at some point you get bored with everything, you know, you've seen all the different types of a certain kind and you start going for more. And the technology behind different sites that of the type that you're talking about there, which are the sort of tube sites, you call them, like Pornhub and such like, I guess. Their recommendation engines are really, really well, really intelligent and really well targeted, so that the stuff that they're recommending to you around what you're watching is like that. And they have, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and it's just, it's not just, so we've talked about YouTube having the kind of algorithms to make things ever more hardcore. My son was sitting in the back of the car the other day and told me about that there are five places on Earth that where gravity doesn't exist, and also that there's a good case to be made that the Earth's actually flat. And I was like, what do you mean? And it turns out he just watched some YouTube videos after having them recommended after he was watching other stuff.
Yeah, and they're clickbaity titles. You can see that straight away, can't you?
It's interesting. I must get about 15, 20 emails a day because I'm on a list of like journalists. Like I'm on a, because I have a blog and whatever. So I get sent all kinds of stuff. And occasionally I get one that says P-Hub, as in Pornhub, launches new feature, like female friendly porn or whatever. Oh, and really? You know, I delete most of them, but occasionally things I'm like, what is this thing here? And it's just interesting to see how, you know, we've talked before about how new technologies are often taken up first in the porn industry, like VR, for example, perfect example there, etc. But in this article by Steuer, she says, quote, we cannot rely on pornography to teach empathy, the ability to read body language, or how to discuss sexual boundaries, especially when we're talking about young people who have never had sex. Porn will never be a replacement for sex education, end of quote.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, and that's what the guy today was saying as well. You know, you have to, because what's happening is that people are learning about sex through porn sites before they have sex, even remotely, you know, years before.
Oh, yeah.
And that's problematic. And obviously they're using it through the free stuff. And it brings me back to a thing I discussed with Amy Burville, I think, a time ago, the idea of that we should be providing, if pornography is being used by young people and we can't physically stop that from happening and we're concerned about the quality of that content, then surely we should be providing a healthy bank of pornography for young people to be using, and that we're actually getting this the wrong way around, kind of thing.
I can't see how there would ever be a situation, because you've mentioned that before. I know where you're coming from. I just can't imagine there ever being a public acceptance of that.
No, I absolutely agree. But I think, I don't see how you make it work, and certainly not under current laws where you have 18-year-old restrictions and that kind of thing. But it's just one of those things. Mind you, saying that, lots of stuff that we did when we were young was illicit, you know, to do with, pornography in magazines and things, but possibly, but also alcohol, smoking, staying out late, whatever it might be. You know, you do things you do naughty things, don't you? And it's, it's difficult. But where it's problematic is where it starts to affect people's relationships. And he was saying that, what was it? Something had just been certified as an addictive substance, not substance, as an addictive activity. So like, for example, gambling is addictive. And what? I can't remember. I'll have to come back to it.
Okay, cool.
But it's interesting. So pornography is not yet just medically defined as this.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. Well, there we are. How do we get from YouTube art through to porn be provided to every teenager?
I think.
I blame the algorithm, I have to say. well, while we're talking about people behind corners touching themselves, maybe there's an interesting link here on geek social fallacies, which this was referenced. So this is, I think this is about 10 years old, but it was referenced in something I read last week. And I think that the rabbit hole that I started off, it was started at Hacker News. Mm. And it's a really interesting list of five geek social fallacies. And, you know, you think, oh, well, the geeks are just different from everyone else. And maybe I do self-identify as a bit of a geek. And I've actually linked to the bottom, not to the front page. But there we are. It's actually, so it's 15 years old, five geek social fallacies. Geek social fallacy number one, ostracizers are evil.
Where does it say that?
The link, actually, I'm just going to link directly to it. So I'm going to change the link in the show notes. There you go.
Doug has thought shrapnel thing. Okay, here we go. Number one, ostracizers are evil. So who are they and what are they doing?
Well, I think the point is that, especially geeks are very sensitive to ostracism because they may have been ostracized themselves. Yeah. And so it says that many geeks have had horrible, humiliating, and formative experiences with ostracism, and the notion of being on the other side of the transaction is repugnant to them. So as a result, the exclusion of anyone in geek circles from anything, be it a party, comic book store, a web forum, no matter how obnoxious, offensive, or aromatic the prospective excluding may be. And it says, as a result, nearly every geek social group of significant size has at least one member that 80% of the members hate and the remaining 20% merely tolerate.
But that's a good thing, sort of, isn't it? I mean, to be inclusive is a good thing here.
Yeah, but as the end of that section says, there's a number of unpleasant consequences. For one thing, it actively hinders the wider acceptance of geek-related activities. I don't know that RPGs and comics will be more popular if there are fewer trolls who smell of cheese hustling the new blood, but I'm sure it couldn't hurt.
No. I don't think that's... I don't know. Yeah, okay. I think ostracizing people is bad.
It's saying that you shouldn't necessarily tolerate people who are dickheads.
The question is why they're being ostracized, isn't it? So it's quite. So I live in quite a remote community, really a small community, and there are people whom I see reasonably. And there's one guy I see, an old gentleman, retired teacher, and he's got an alcohol issue. And I've eaten at least six meals with him, sitting opposite him or next to him, and he didn't remember who I was when I saw him earlier this week. It was a shocker, and he was absolutely humiliated and embarrassed or whatever when he found out that he knew me, which I didn't remind him of that fact, but he asked me which boarding house I was in, because I told him that then it was the same one he was in when he was at the school. I never worked with him. That was a bit strange. But so if he's there, you know, you invite him to sit with you, it's fine.
And but I think this is less that kind of like, oh, well, you know, let's be inclusive. I think it's more like if someone is consistently being an asshole, it's okay not to hang out with them.
Yeah. But then the thing is, if there's not that person in the group, then it's that person's probably you. Isn't that what they say?
Number two is friends accept me as I am. And so the fallacy is that, hey, you just have to accept me as I am because this is the way things are, as opposed to, like, you have to, you know, change your behavior sometimes when you're acting around people, like self-censor, maybe avoid conflict, etc. And so you shouldn't expect everyone to love you unconditionally.
No, that's fair. I don't expect anyone to love me unconditionally. In fact, if anybody actually loves me, I think it's because they don't actually know me well enough. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, yeah, but if you knew this about me, then you'd just run a mile. But that's the way it goes, isn't it? The human condition in my world.
It is. And then just to quickly rattle through them, there's Geek Social Fallacy 3, Friendship Before All, as in like, it's like a friendship test fallacy. In this case, the carrier believes that any failure by a friend to put the interests of the friendship above all else means they aren't really friend at all.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, number 4, friendship is transitive.
I'd say
so. This is basically it's using awkward language to basically say, like,
it's temporary.
Wouldn't it be great to get all of my groups together, friends together, in one place for one big happy party? As if because everybody likes me, and I've got and all of my friends have got me in common, they'll all get on well together.
Yeah, no, that's a big deal.
Which is obviously not true.
Yeah, so I mean, I've lived with this. So because I moved around every 2 years when I was a kid, so I had groups of friends from different places, and I used to kind of think, oh, they should all come together because they're all my friends, and then you kind of think, actually, no. I actually had quite a fear about different groups of friends meeting, an irrational fear, I think. aren't they all? But my groups of friends meeting and thinking.
What you just described, Di.
Sorry?
If you meet them at different stages in your life, they almost know you as a different kind of person.
No, completely. They would. And it was quite scary to me. So even to the extent that you're like the person I would be at home. And the person I would be at school would be very, very different. And it would feel like that. Mm. But actually, that's not true. Of course it wasn't true. You're just thinking that people see, you know, it's just, the mind is too busy. It thinks about the wrong things. That's all I'm going to say.
Number 5, Geek Social Fallacy 5, friends do everything together. So, I just thought it was interesting because obviously, you know, stereotypical geeks take this too extreme, but I think we all are subject to this in some way.
I think that's true. It's very rare. So I think friendships are really interesting things, aren't they? That happen over a long time. So long-term friendships, and they take effort, they take work, and I meet a lot of people who don't have very many friends, and it's quite interesting for different reasons. And that's it's quite difficult to deal with. I found friendships obviously have taken a very different stance since I separated from my family, which is now 4 years ago nearly. But now I have, clear and strong friendships, I feel, and I make the effort to keep them up, as it were.
It just reminded me, actually, of something else that I came across this week. Again, this was referenced in something else I was reading, and this particular article comes from 2012, so 6 years ago. But it was in the New York Times, again.
Uh-huh.
And it was saying about how difficult it is, especially in the 30s, or above your 30s, to make new friends?
I mean, I have to do that now. But I have made new friends above 30, definitely. You're one of them, actually, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's just look at it. So the sociologist since the 1950s, it says that three things are crucial to making close friends. Okay, proximity, repeated unplanned interactions, and a setting that encourages people to let their guard down and confide in each other.
Yeah.
And so the point is that university or school is a really good place for this. You know, you meet people on a regular basis. There are unplanned interactions, and you can confide in each other because you're around each other a lot, and maybe you've got alcohol, especially university. I was just reflecting on my life and how I've never really had a particularly wide group of friends, and I've had lots of acquaintances, but I guess some people see me as a bit emotionally distant. That's my wife. I don't know.
That's your wife, you say? No, that's my wife. I think it's fair, isn't it? So I think, I mean, I'm very friendly in my work and things like that. But I worked at my last school for 9 years, and I also did a physical separation from that area. But I don't see anybody from there. When I did bump into a couple of people, it's very friendly and very nice. And it's not that we wouldn't spend time together. It's just I don't go back there, but maybe I'm just not going back to that part of my life as well. So It's an interesting thing, but I'm very conscious being a teacher, you know, even in a school of the nature of mine, we have like a 10% turnover each year or something. And it's, you know, people just move off and you keep in touch. I make an effort to keep in touch with some people and go and visit them and things like that. But I think, especially since we're a boarding school, that other people coming back feel a real pressure to hang out with everyone if they're actually coming back. And that kind of thing. And obviously life doesn't lend itself to that in many ways. You've got children and then that kind of thing. You know, I know
you know, you talked before about having different friends in different places.
Uh-huh.
I find it interesting because I don't really want to be that person that I grew up with, that I was as a teenager anymore. It was different. It almost feels like a different person. So hanging out with people who I knew at that point would force me to be that person. And so, you know, that's why I think going away to university is really important. And especially in the days before, you could easily keep in touch with people back home. Mm-hmm. And I feel kind of sorry for people who are, I feel like that some people, and maybe I'm just being too judgmental here, but I feel like some people are trapped in being the kind of person, like trapped in a false consistency because they're still friends, even just on Facebook, with people who they knew when they were much younger.
Yes, I think it is an interesting bar, even psychologically speaking, really, is to think, oh, I'm talking to this person, but this person thinks I'm what I was 30 years ago or whatever. And that's a really strange affair because, but they don't, because they're obviously intelligent individuals as well in one degree or another. So it's a tricky thing, I think. But you do move on through life. So I have a friend from when I was 11 and I still see him. But I don't see him every day, and he'd probably drive me insane if I did. Oh, actually, no, I quite like him. When I see him now, I just think, yeah, but for different reasons to when we were kids. But and we've been through a lot together and apart, and it's a weird idea, I think. I don't know.
Well, the last quotation I've just, you know, the last quotation I've put on this thought shrapnel thing is, it says, external factors are not the only hurdle. After 30, people often experience internal shifts in how they approach friendship. Self-discovery gives way to self-knowledge, so you become pickier about whom you surround yourself with, says Marla Paul, author of the 2004 book, The Friendship Crisis, Finding, Making, and Keeping Friends When You're Not a Kid Anymore. The bar is higher than when we were younger and more willing to meet almost anyone for a margarita, she said. Manipulators, drama queens, egomaniacs, a lot of them just no longer make the cut, end of quote.
Yeah, I think that's a true thing. And I'm very open to new people. I'm very curious about them, but it's very rare that someone becomes a long-standing friend. I don't know. I go on holiday with people.
I think people have different bars for friendship as well. And I tell you what was really interesting. Did you see that new social network called Vero?
Vero? No, I haven't seen that. What is it?
I think Vero, let's see, Vero.com maybe. Yeah, Vero.co, because it's a cool new thing. Anyway, this new social network, when you sign up for it, it's a bit like, I don't know, Google Plus Circles or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it asks you to put people in categories of like close friends, and acquaintances. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm almost like everyone I know. I would struggle to know which one to put them in. Like, you know, awkward question to be asked to ask you on this podcast would be like, hey, you know, which category would you put me in, kind of thing. And yeah, so I just don't think that's the way the world works, and it depends on context as well. So
I think people do this already on Facebook, but you don't it's not as upfront about it. You go and create your own groups and see what those groups are going to. So I used to do this loads. I remember having loads of friends on Facebook and thinking, what the hell are they doing here? And so I went and categorized them and put them into this category, which I don't even know who's in it anymore. It was that long ago that I did it, and I never kept it up as a sort of discipline, if you like. So it lost its structure pretty quickly. But I think it's the big bubble, I think, that's yet to pop in tech is as soon as people can see who has been, like on LinkedIn, when you know, if you pay for LinkedIn, you can see who has done this. Well, if people really wanted to make money out of Facebook, if it started going down the tubes and things like that, then they would say, if you pay me money, you can see who has looked at your page and what they looked at your profile, what they've looked at, blah, 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 of the history of your account. That information out there, it's like the taboo. It's the thing that you won't show people, but it's the reason that the site is successful. It's because you can go and stalk people and check them out and see who they are before being friends with them, or indeed after, when you're friends with them. I think people get a kick out of that. I know one of my children had a real issue with that and then stopped using Facebook forever when he was 15. Because he just realized that it was encouraging in him really poor behavior.
No, definitely. And I think it's fine if it's explicitly public, like Twitter, for example. What Facebook is that weird liminal space where you're not really sure.
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, if you have a private list in Twitter, you don't know that you don't know if you're in my particular list or not, because you don't know my list exists.
You're on my shit list, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, no, but that's it. But so I have a list of sort of thing of a sort of honed down list of things that I go and check because the noise is too much from, I think I follow 1600 people or something, and it's too noisy to sort of, so that I get to the good things. I have a list called, that no one knows about, called friends, which doesn't have very many people in it at all, and that's so I know what people how people are using Twitter in a kind of day-to-day way. And that's why they're on it, and what's going on in their lives, and sort of thing. And then I have a list, but the lists aren't public. Some of the lists aren't public. Some of them are.
Well, that's just I'd completely forgotten that I do this, but yeah, I've got the same. I've got one called Core, and I put people on there who I don't really want to miss their tweets. But then I use Twitter less now, so yeah.
Yeah. So I do. Yeah. So I have those lists, and then I use Hootsuite to follow the lists. That's how I use Twitter mostly.
Yeah. I've just put a link in there to Google's new Slack competitor. Have you used this? Have you seen it?
Not yet. It's turned on for my organization, but I haven't used it yet. Have you?
Yeah. So it's turned on for Moodle. I can't. I pay for Google, the G Suite thing for Dynamic Skill Set, which is my business. So the only people who have accounts on there are my wife and I. And it hasn't been rolled out for that domain yet. It's part of just G Suite. But yeah, I have used it for Moodle because Moodle uses it as well. And although I'm only using it with one other person at the moment. Hang on, is this chat? There we are. I find it, like for a Google product, surprisingly confusing, I have to say.
Right, I'm just having a look. I'm just doing an image search on it now. Is it Google Chat Hangouts? Is that the thing?
So the idea is that it's got all these bots in and everything like that, and integrations and stuff. But it's not. I mean, when I describe it, it sounds great in that every time you start a discussion, it's like a separate little card thing within the Slack-style chat. And so you can be having multiple conversations and multiple things. But it's just, like, the UI is a bit weird. Anyway, Tom Murdoch, who is head of the education team, he was trying out with me. He loves it. He thinks it's great. And I can see why he thinks it's fantastic. Just for me, it just feels a bit awkward. I don't know.
I'm just trying to find images, but it doesn't look like there are any.
Like, you can't, for example, I feel like you get to a certain stage where if a competitor launches a product, there's almost like table stakes, as people say, like things you have to include. So on Slack, for example, which you and I use on the, you know, We Are Open Slack channel, if I just want to reply to someone using the emoji, I can do that. And you can react and has a little icon underneath. Can't do that on Hangouts chat. And it's just, it just doesn't feel polished. But then I suppose it's quite neat.
The tool. So is it hangouts.google.com or is it something different?
No, it's called Hangouts Chat. So I've put a link to the Engadget article on Thought Shrapnel there, just because when you go to the actual page for it, it's a bit confusing as to how you even get into it, never mind anything else. So when you click through to that and go to the Engadget one, it gives you examples. And obviously with the screenshots, it looks great. So for example, because it's got all of your calendars in there, you can say, plan a review meeting with everyone in this chat, and it'll find a good time for everyone.
Right, yeah. Oh, I don't get it. No, there's not many pictures in here. I'm not getting it.
What, Engadget one? You just need to scroll down a bit. Maybe you've got too many blockers on.
No way. Okay. Google's Productivity Suite now shows you who viewed your files. That's what we were just talking about a minute ago, really. Cool. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, the devil is in the detail. I can see this down here. That looks sort of interesting. There's too much grayed out stuff on the image, though, for me to get a real feel of what it's like. But you have guests and you have rooms. Oh, that's setting a thing. Okay. It'll be interesting. I mean, I have found that about everything that I've used. So Microsoft Teams is similar, to be fair, is that it has this thing where you create a group of people and then it automatically creates a thread in that called General, which is not dissimilar to Slack, I guess. But because, you know, as soon as you start using it, you kind of think, okay, well, I'm going to have quite a few groups of people for every one of my classes and then the different groups that I'm involved in to do with sport and to do with digital strategy and whatever. So there's going to be lots of groups and then they're all going to have these different threads inside each of them, you just start to get a little bit fed up. So I have my school instance is the one that's closest to that. So I have... So I have class of 2018, class of 2019, digital leaders, the Holy Grail, which is just administration, and then random general and Black Friday deals. And some of them are locked and some of them are not. And that kind of works for me. I kind of get that sort of thing. But it's just because you have the root channels, but I don't have anything within those channels. Do you know what I
mean? No, and if it works, it works. And it might be, you know, it works especially well for people who haven't experienced Slack before. But Moodle runs a lot of Telegram, and I've mentioned before how I use Telegram a lot. But both Slack and Telegram, you can, you know, okay, so in the Google Hangouts chat, you can, you know, have different conversations. But let's say the conversation is a really long one. You still haven't got any kind of threaded or nested responses. So let's say that you're participating in conversation, you go into a meeting, you come out of the meeting, and you want to reply to the third response in that chat, and there's now 100 responses after that. In Telegram, you would just hold down, you know, your finger on the touchscreen onto the thing you want to reply to, and then you could quote that thing in your reply. And if someone clicked on it, it would like scroll back up to where that person originally said it. Uh-huh. In Slack, you can create a threaded conversation.
Yes.
In Hangouts chat, you just have to append it to the end of the 100 comments after it.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, Slack used to be like that, and that was pain in the butt. It was really difficult.
Yeah.
We'll have to see, won't we? I mean, you have to use it to really understand it, and your guy is really enjoying it. So I'm assuming he knows Slack too, but he might not though.
Right, and like when Google Classroom came out, it was a bit crap, and now it's much better.
That's true. That's true. But it still looks the same as it ever did. But yeah. I mean, the reason Google Classroom was so good is because it just hung, you know, the fact that they've called this Hangouts is bad for me. I just think Hangouts are video calling. That's what Hangouts are. So why,
you know. And you can do video calling there. And also they've got a million different chat products, it seems.
Yes, this is the thing, isn't it? So do you remember Allo and Duo? Two sort of video one and a text one. And, you know, I'm not sure that Google have really got this sorted, to be honest. But this might be a cool thing. I don't know. We'll see. But it is just Slack, pretty much.
Well, pretty much. And I think I haven't, although I've used Slack a lot and I like it, I do like, as I've said before, Atlassian's Stride, because that has different features in terms of understanding that people need to turn off and do deep work and then come back and catch up with what's happened. Or in my case, working for an Australian organization, catch up with what people have been working on overnight.
Yes. Yes, that's an important thing.
And the way that works, as we've discussed before, at stride.com, it allows you to set do not disturb modes or deep thinking modes or whatever. And in the conversation, you can mark things as decisions being made or what else is it? There's something else you can do as well. And it's got all the video chat and everything in there as well. So when you come out of that deep work mode, or if you've been asleep, you can come out of that focus mode and you can see the decisions that have been made and actions that have been taken, etc.
Okay, that'd be interesting. I'll give it a go when it comes out. I did a remote lesson this week with my lower six. I've been given a lesson on Saturday morning for some reason, and so I could take a longer time getting up, really. I mean, so I was ready to go, but I could have another cup of coffee. I did the lesson just through Slack, and it was really cool. Just set them up different questions to go and answer, and then discussed the findings and gave them different instructions on what they had to feed back and responded to those accordingly. That was good. I think they enjoyed it. I see them tomorrow, so I'll ask them what they felt.
Cool. No, I think you talked about Slack lessons before, and I think it's interesting because when you are comparing tools like this, which are all workplace chat tools, really, they've all got different affordances. And I think that sometimes when you live within a Google bubble or Microsoft bubble or, you know, Atlassian bubble or whatever, you forget that there are people designing this and that things can be a different way. And even little differences make a huge difference in practice.
They do. Getting people involved in these things, though, is tricky. If they're not used to being on chat apps, you know, they have to sign in and download it on the phone and then have some conversation. They just don't get it. It's quite bizarre.
Well, this is the issue I've got with Project MoodleNet. So one of the good things is we've got 2 million registered people on Moodle.org, 40,000 active users, I think. And so there's a tranche of people who I can push towards and pay attention to MoodleNet when it's ready. But for a lot of stuff that I've been researching, it's pretty, you know, some really good stuff that I've been looking at. But because they're starting from scratch, they just don't get any community, don't get any traction at all.
No, getting traction is the deal. That's the gig. That's the real challenge that you face.
So where should we go next? I saw this thing on MIT, which was 10 breakthrough technologies for 2018. I don't know if you had a chance to have a look at this.
Oh, we discussed this last week, I think. But there's no problem discussing it again.
What did we talk about last week? Well, we might as well talk about it now if you want to. It's up to you.
No, that's it's brilliant. So because I think it's really interesting, they've been doing this, and we all know that predicting the future is a tricky thing. So it's very interesting to know what MIT Technology Review, which you imagine has a lot of technologists as its as part of its editing body and its, you know, collating and whatever. The integrity of it would be good. So let's have a go. So first up is 3D metal printing.
Yeah, and so it talks about how last year a 3D printing company called Markforged released the first 3D metal printer for under $100,000. And you think, oh, well, that's way out of my league. And, you know, I bought a 3D printer for 300, 400 quid. But actually, these things come down in price quickly and pretty dramatically. So imagine 3D printing metal stuff. That's insane.
Well, it is. We have a 3D metal printer at school.
Do you?
Which costs $250,000, I think.
What? And,
yeah, it was paid for by a donation. So yeah, I don't know. It's a bit weird. It only prints in like matchbox size, though. It doesn't get any bigger than that. They use it in F1 teams and things like that.
Oh, okay. Because it does give a car an example here. It says, in the short term, manufacturers wouldn't need to maintain large inventories. They could simply print an object, such as a replacement part for an aging car, when someone needs it. So it's like print on demand for books, but for everything.
Yeah, no, and absolutely. And the point is when it gets to the price point where that example that you used would be possible. So actually replacing, you know, for an old car, having a $100,000 machine is not going to work, and it will take ages, and it will probably cost a lot of money to print that thing. And it's not going to be financially viable anyway. So, but interesting. So that's 3D printing steel girders and things like that.
Yeah. So the next one is artificial embryos.
Okay, does this mean fake babies?
It says there's no egg, no sperm, just cells plucked from another embryo.
Okay, so it never was really an embryo. And so you take the cells, and because the cells are the nature of the kind of stem cells or whatever that they are, they can reproduce independently and separately. We know that stem cells are magical, the powerful potential of what they can do. We did not realize they could self-organize so beautifully or perfectly, says Magdalena Zenica-Goetz, who headed the team. Wow. Synthetic embryos, these
but
are.
But presumably these would be clones, yeah?
I had an interesting conversation with our head of science about cloning the other day, and he was telling me what he felt the really exciting developments were in that field. At the moment, we're talking about, there's been some cloning happen recently, which was similar to Dolly the sheep cloning. And the support for cloning comes from the idea that genetically engineering something is really, really, really fiddly, really difficult to achieve and get right. And cloning is easier than that. So the point being is that you would genetically engineer whatever it is you wanted, and then you would clone from that point forwards, because cloning is a more straightforward production process, even though that's still really difficult. It's just not as difficult as the other thing.
But it reduces resiliency. Were we talking about those crayfish that had cloned recently or not?
The fish, did you say?
Crayfish. Did you see that?
Oh, no, I didn't see that, no.
See if I can find it. Yeah, so basically what had happened was, I think it was crayfish. Yeah, here it is. Europe is being taken over by crayfish that can clone themselves, right? So basically these crayfish had developed some kind of genetic mutation so they didn't have to reproduce by having sex, basically. And so what it means is that they were just, you know, taking over aquariums. So I think it was started off in Germany. German aquarium owners just started dumping them in the lakes. And now they're massive and they're taking over everything. But although the population's exploding, some people have said, well, actually, because they've all got the same DNA, they've got the same susceptibility to disease and changing environmental conditions. So it'll only take one thing to wipe out the entire species rather than having that kind of genetic resilience.
All right. Okay. Yeah. We'll just kill every single one of them. Mm. Well, that'll be interesting, won't it? Because they're not evolved, but they must be evolved in certain regards. But if that one thing catches, then I guess they all die. Wow. Well,
yeah, exactly.
That's pretty...
Yes, the next one is kind of smart city schemes linked to Internet of Things, so calling a sensing city.
Knows where you are all of the time. The plan calls for all vehicles to be autonomous and shared. Robots will roam underground doing menial chores like delivering mail. Sidewalk Labs says it will open access to the software and systems it's creating to other companies so they can build services on top of them. And you can build apps for phones and stuff.
And this is happening in Toronto on the waterfront.
What's distinctive about what we're trying to do in Quayside is that the project is not extraordinarily ambitious, but also has a certain amount of humility, says the executive in charge. The humility may help Quayside avoid the pitfalls that have plagued previous smart city initiatives.
Well, from what I mean, obviously I'm going to read a lot of people who are skeptical about this, but it is like surveillance central, basically.
Oh, God, yeah. I completely like that. Yeah. I mean, that is going to be is the great thing of the future, is how much everything is pervasive into our lives. It's just, you know, then there are going to be people who are like, well, it doesn't matter that they've got my data. And there are going to be people like, yeah, but I just got deported because they got my data. And or whatever it might be. So
I read something the other day, and I can't remember where I read it, but it was saying that if there's four photos of you publicly available online, then like any camera in the world can detect who you are, pretty much.
Fantastic.
Like any CCTV.
So I am detectable, I guess, because there certainly are four about me. I was thinking about this. Mm-hmm. You know the Russian spy that's just been assassinated by Russia? That,
yeah.
You know, was living in the UK down in...
Somewhere. A double agent. Yeah.
And he has a daughter, and his daughter's also in hospital, critically ill, through the assassination attempt, using nerve gas or nerve drug, some kind of chemical warfare, chemical weapon. And I thought, well, she must have grown up in the UK for most of her life, and will be using the platforms, because I'm always looking for cases where, because people say, well, I don't have anything to hide. But the point being...
Interesting that's she has split her life between UK and Russia, apparently.
Oh, has she? Okay, so not quite the same. Yeah. Don't know. All right.
But you're right. I mean, given that the Russian influence in all different kinds of elections and stuff, I don't think we can think that we're safe just because we're using, you know, UK, American, EU products and services.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you have to... you have to do this. One of the things that we had a really interesting conversation about last week, I felt, that has sat with me through the week, if you know what I mean, was when we talked about the attention economy, but we aligned attention, or substituted the word attention for love, is that, so attention is the love that you give your children, for example, is attention. And we were discussing it from that point of view. So if you think now we're in this attention economy, and our phone, so every time we were talking about, every time you use your phone, you shout something out loud, or you say out loud what it is you're going to use your phone for, so that you just use it for that thing and don't get sucked into a rabbit hole on any of the others. And on the other apps, but the apps are designed to pull you in. They're designed to sit in the back of your mind, pulling you in from here, there, and everywhere.
Right. And let me just comment on that then. So we did talk about that last week, and about like, I am now going on my phone to check my emails, and then I'm going to turn it off. Okay. And what I found is, so I turned on because I was talking to, for a couple of reasons. First of all, as part of my research with Project MoodleNet, I wanted to look at, you know, voice activation and how that could be used potentially in the app. And also I was talking to my son about, you know, voice assistants and how they don't know everything and where the information comes from. I've installed the Alexa app on his device because I can't do the Google Assistant because it's fast enough. But I have been using Google Now on my device, partly as well because I'm happy with GDPR and the way that Google have set things up. I can delete stuff out of there now. It's great. So I've been using it. And I'll give you an example. I've been using it to do as much of the crossword as possible with my wife. And then often we'll look up the last two if we can't do them.
Yeah.
And there's a definite difference between typing something in and I'm looking at the screen while I'm doing it instead of at her or the paper versus doing it in a voice way where it feels more inclusive. And I feel that as we have to look at our phones less, that will change the dynamic a bit.
No, I think so. The voice assistant has that amazing thing about it, which I'm familiar with because I don't use Google Home or Google OK, whatever it's called, assistant. But I do use Alexa, obviously, but I don't talk to her very much. I mean, she must think I'm bad company, which is she knows me well, but there is real mileage in voice activated computers. But that only, this is the interesting thing, is it only removes percepted barriers. So barriers that I perceive between me and the technology, it removes them to the extent where it actually becomes a pleasure to, not a pleasure, but it feels right to do something that has more obstacles in the way between you and the technology. Although in the first instance, I think as you've experienced, there is this great sort of liberation about no mouse, no keyboard, no screen, you know, just voice and audio interaction as a user interface. It's great kind of thing. And it's not as...
I agree. And I just feel quite conversational. It's still kind of... What I've found since the last time I used, actually, it used to be that if you said, okay, Google... If anyone said it, it would recognize that and respond to it. But my son is now very frustrated that it only responds to my voice and no one else's, which is great. And obviously that had to be the case, given that they've got those little Echo type devices, because otherwise you just, anyone at a party could say anything, couldn't they? Order me, you know, 50,000 tuna steaks.
Yeah, they could do that. Well, it depends what you've got set up. So I don't have calling set up, but I saw these little things on Amazon website where they have little screens on, just little pods that, you know, you hold in the palm of your hand kind of thing, but it has a screen on and you can call people and with video call them on it. And I thought, well, that's kind of sensible and cool to have in your house. And but equally, you just get this thing where you just don't want to... where the tech will disappear, and that's what the voice allows. What's what voice activation allows, the tech just disappears. You end up with speakers in every room, and it just gives you whatever it is that you're after through that. And I think,
which is great, but again, talking to my son from a like information digital literacy point of view, in terms of, you know, Alexa is just pulling stuff from the internet, and if the stuff on the internet is wrong, the answer is wrong. Yeah, it's not like it's this omnipotent being.
This is it. It is credible. It is credible that the world is flat and there are five places on the earth where gravity does not exist.
Well, indeed, yeah. And so it's an interesting thing. I think we often give voice assistants to kids to amuse them, but of course they're asking them all kinds of questions. So
we've talked about this before, I think,
in an article.
Where that, and a guy did it deliberately with his son and to see what it would be. But the thing is...
Well, it was Brett Gaylor. I used to work with him, Mozilla.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think the thing is that you do have... it is really compelling. It is really lovely. It isn't really a problem, except for the fact... I mean, tech is going to disappear so that it becomes invisible, not so it's not there. And the things that make people, you know, if it makes you use it more, makes you feel more comfortable using it, it fits more seamlessly into your life without you questioning it being there, it's going to be backed by these companies and just get better and better and better, as we have found with voice interface.
Yeah. I'll put a link to that Okay Google video by Brett if you want to watch it again.
So after that, Sensing City, we're next up is...
All right. So, yes, back to the article. So it's talking about Sensing City. It's talking about AI for everybody, machine learning in the cloud, pre-trained systems, etc.
Yep, absolutely. So AI is going to dilute itself and ring itself around, put itself in the cloud. So you don't have the machine next to you that's doing the thing. You have massive libraries, open source AI libraries they're talking about here, used to build other machine learning softwares. There's lots of things going on. So if you're interested in that.
Well, there's a couple of things I think which are interesting here, which I've heard, you know, like weak signals people talking about in the past. So one of them is that in the future you'll have an algorithm on your team. And that's a, you know, if you imagine someone coming from the past, like the near past or the far past, and you have to explain what's going on, it kind of all feels like magic when you conceptualize it from that point of view. And so you could say, I've got, you know, we have algorithms on our team right now. We have algorithms on our teaching staff. We have algorithms as part of our teams in tech companies, etc. The other thing is that, you know, I've read about how philosophy graduates in 10, 15 years' time are going to be more valuable than computer science graduates because, you know, you're going to be able to just describe the kind of system you want to create and it will know better than humans how to create that system.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, this is the obvious limitation of people against machines is that if once artificial intelligence and machine learning is all, you know, is a bit further than where it is now, the point being is that a person has to learn so much and that just keeps increasing to be up to speed, if you like, where the computers can get there so much faster.
Well, can you remember there was that example of Facebook had created AI that could talk to other AI? And then it developed a language to talk to each other, which humans couldn't understand.
Had they done that? I don't remember something about that. I don't remember in detail.
I'm sure we talked about that because that links nicely into the next one on the list, which is dueling. I think this is badly titled, actually. Dueling neural networks. Basically, what it's saying is that you put two AIs together, and one is the what does it describe it? One is the generator, and one is the discriminator. So one is tasked with creating variations on images that it's already seen, perhaps a picture of a pedestrian with an extra arm. And the second, the discriminator, is asked to identify whether the example it sees is like the images it's been trained on or fake produced by the generator. Basically, is that three-armed person likely to be real? And so it's basically teaching AI to talk to each other so it can do cool new stuff.
Mm. And so it says why it matters is it gives the machine something akin to a sense of imagination, which may help them become less reliant on humans, but also turns them into an alarmingly powerful tools into alarmingly before digital fakery, obviously, key players at the moment.
And I think, I don't know if you, going back to the porn example, I don't know if you saw all the controversy around deepfakes and putting like, what's the actress of Wonder Woman, her face onto like porn stars' bodies, but doing it in such a realistic way on video that you couldn't really tell the difference.
Oh, wow, really? No, I haven't heard about that at all. Yeah.
Well, that's something to Google after this podcast.
Or not, as the case may be.
Or not. Next one, Babel Fish earbuds. So this comes from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You put a Babel Fish in your ear and you instantly get translations. And we're very close to this. I think Skype already does this in some way.
Mm. Well, this is, I mean, we've seen this for a while with different things to do with Google and cameras and stuff where it will translate text immediately. And then obviously if you have your phone in the middle and someone talks into your phone in their language, it will translate it into your language. And so this is really available right here, right now, I'd argue. But them being on an earbud is obviously a step up. And it would be interesting to see how well you could converse with such a thing, because the whole point of a conversation is that it takes its it's a beautiful play between two people when two people aren't fluent in each of the languages. When I was in France last summer, I think I was having, you know, two-hour, three-hour conversations with French people, only English person in the room, and their English wasn't great. My French was better than their English, and we managed to have long conversations about all sorts of things, and that was quite fantastic. And Duolingo had helped me get my French up to speed a little bit, but it was very, very enjoyable, the sort of fabric, the quality of the fabric of our relationships in that short time that I was on holiday or a week, whatever, was great. We really enjoyed each other's company, etc. Whereas if we were talking using Babel buds, then I'm not sure it would have had that sort of magic about it. But obviously,
I think this is more like, you know, you're having a business conversation or you're doing a business trip or it's a temporary thing or you're connecting with someone who you don't know that well or whatever. I think definitely you'd want to find the middle ground in the situation you describe. But I think this is maybe a different use case. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, we will have its uses, obviously, and in being an interpreter, a translator or whatever, interpreter is a job. So, I mean, therefore, if this can take that out of the equation, then that's got to be pretty cool. Interesting. Okay, next up is
the next one.
Zero carbon natural gas.
Yes, zero carbon natural gas. So I don't quite understand this.
No, okay. But, so the breakthrough is a power plant efficiently and cheaply captures carbon released by burning natural gas, avoiding greenhouse gas emissions. It matters because around 32% of US electricity is produced with natural gas, accounting for around 30% of the power sector's carbon emissions.
Oh, I see. It says the plant puts the carbon dioxide released from burning natural gas under high pressure and heat, using the resulting supercritical CO2 as the working fluid that drives a specially built turbine. Much of the carbon dioxide can be continuously recycled. The rest can be captured cheaply.
All right. Okay. Well, that's quite interesting. That sounds quite massive. Doesn't give any down effects to it. It says it won't solve all the problems with natural gas, particularly on the extraction side. But as long as we're using natural gas, we might as well use it as cleanly as possible, of course. And of all the clean energy technologies in development, Net Powers is one of the furthest along to promise more than a marginal advance in cutting carbon emissions. So this is like I suppose you're going to get to a revolutionary technology in the consumption of natural fuels. Cool. Next.
The next one is, it claims, is perfect online privacy.
Yes. So the breakthrough here is that computer scientists are perfecting a cryptographic tool for proving something without revealing the information underlying the proof. If you need to disclose, so I think this is definitely going to come our way. If you need to disclose personal information to get something done online, it will be easier to do so without risking your privacy or exposing yourself to identity theft. So this is happening in a certain way with things like LastPass, the password manager, where you can share, I could share a password for one of my accounts with you by giving you a temporary access to it via LastPass if you're a LastPass user and I'm a LastPass user, and that kind of thing. So you won't actually ever know the password or be able to find it out because it's encrypted and whatever, but I can still pass it, my password, onto you without it being exposed, which is the sort of thing this is talking about, isn't it?
Well, I think there's been ways of doing this for a while. So, for example, Sweden, I think for a few years has had a system where you have some kind of card or some way of proving that you're old enough to, for example, buy alcohol without having to reveal your identity or
age.
Like your age or whatever. Just it's like, is this person old enough to buy alcohol? Yes or no? And it just runs like that. And it reminds me, because I think there's an added layer here of like Bitcoin stuff and cryptocurrency, whatever. But it reminds me of something that Vinay Gupta told me about. So this is at guptaoption.com/cheapid. And he did some work for the US Department of Defense in 2006, so 12 years ago, which was providing genocide-resistant identification. So the problem is you've got refugees who are going across borders, and they might be part of an ethnic group which is being targeted for ethnic cleansing, for example. And the ID just basically says whether they should be allowed into the country or not. So he says on that particular one, this protects people from abuse of their identity credentials. In at least Rwanda and Iraq, people have been targeted for violence and persecution based on information extracted from their ID card, for example. For example, a last name which identifies them as belonging to a targeted ethnic group. So it uses public key cryptography, 2D barcodes, and biometrics to provide very cheap ways of verifying that someone is allowed to do a thing without doing the whole identity.
Yeah, okay. And then it says, to finish that off, it just says that JP Morgan Chase, which is a bank over in America, a merchant bank, added ZK-SNARKs, which is the technology behind this, to their blockchain-based payment system. So clearly people are taking this seriously, and they could say they foresee it as a means of being able to use cryptocurrencies without losing No, sorry, with anonymity. Without anonymity. Yeah, get rid of the anonymity from them.
Talking of JP Morgan Chase, I watched The Big Short last week, which I think you've recommended before. It was great.
Go on. Is that the one of where they took down America? So the 2008 crash beginnings.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
No, it is a great film. It's an interesting sort of documentary about what happens, isn't it? And it explains the complexities of it and how simple people just doing their job, trying to do a good job, cutting some corners to get a competitive advantage and all that kind of thing, as well as some genuinely bad behavior. Okay, next up.
Well, people respond to incentives, yeah? So number 9, genetic fortune telling.
This is an interesting affair. So you can now, scientists can now use your genome to predict your chances of getting heart disease or breast cancer, or even your IQ. This isn't a surprise to me whatsoever, but the importance of it would be that DNA-based predictions could be the next great public health advance, but they will increase the risks of genetic discrimination, obviously. Massive, massive ethical considerations to this.
Especially in countries without a national health service, for example.
Oh, yes, completely. But even in countries like ours, and there are, you know, people will choose... if you can do baby DNA report card at birth, which is what they're sort of thinking will happen, it'll have predictions on addiction, predictions on sexuality, predictions on different behaviors that they believe DNA can indicate, certain DNAs can indicate.
Yeah, there's lots of implications for this. So my daughter Grace had a higher chance of being Down syndrome, and which, you know, made us think about what we'd do in that situation. We would never terminate an embryo or whatever. So, like, we were having to think about how to adapt our lives for that kind of stuff, whereas other people would do that because they wouldn't want to live with a Down syndrome kid and da, 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 da. So there's that end of the spectrum in terms of designer babies, but there's also the insurance side of things, which, you know, you imagine America, if you fight, you have to declare, you know, you'd have to declare that I have a risk of Alzheimer's or cancer or whatever, and that would just whack your premiums right up, wouldn't it?
It would be disastrous for some if the data was allowed to be used in that way. And once the data's out there, so I mean, this technology is coming. The reason that we're reading this MIT article is because we believe it has integrity, and it's inevitable that these things will come unless they can't work. You have to be in the game.
And this is one of the reasons I opted out of the NHS, or tried to opt out. In the end, it was impossible to do it. The NHS health data thing, because once the data, as you say, once the data is out there, NHS shared their information or some of it with Google DeepMind, and also 23andMe, which I at one point was thinking, oh, maybe I need to do that, and maybe I'll be more informed about my susceptibilities and stuff. That was hacked, and all, you know, people got access to the data and stuff. So, yeah, it's a difficult situation to be in.
It really, really is. And but again, it's one of those things. If it's coming, it's coming, and we have to learn how to. That's why I liked the identity one earlier, the privacy one, because it's people looking to write, how can we use this technology to provide the information that is required, whilst maintaining anonymity or protecting identities, protecting privacy. I think that's really, really important. Last one up is?
Materials quantum leap. So it's talking about quantum computers, which can do things like precisely designing molecules so we can create new compounds and liquids and all kinds of stuff. So that would help everything from batteries that last longer or what compounds that could turn sunlight directly into liquid fuel?
That would be a thing. So quantum computing is a wonderful thing. So can you have a qubit is the question, a quantum bit. So this IBM has simulated the electronic structure of a small molecule using a 7-qubit quantum computer. So understanding molecules in exact detail will allow chemists to design more effective drugs, better materials for distributing and generating energy. That's quite interesting and refers back to the genetic thing. So as the genetic thing moves on, this technology will move on as well. And it's possible that those issues that they're identified in the baby will be changeable, treatable through new technologies that don't yet exist, and new science, essentially science that lies yet undiscovered. So, don't know.
I was thinking about how we're in this weird space at the moment, because presumably in the future we'll be able to, directly influence people's DNA, etc., and be able to remove people's susceptibility to Alzheimer's and certain, genetic or degenerative diseases. So that's in the future. Whereas right now we're at almost like peak being able to keep people alive without being able to do that. So I'm absolutely for keeping people, no matter what's wrong with them, alive and, giving them a good quality of life. But if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, we are ones which aren't great adaptations or quirks in DNA. We're keeping those people alive, but we can't get rid of that kind of problem with the DNA for future generations, if that makes sense. I'm not trying to be, eugenics in any way. I'm just saying that, like, we're keeping people alive, which is fine, which have difficulties with their DNA. Whereas in future, we'll be able to modify that.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's the thing, is that we don't have the whole picture. And the whole picture is never there, obviously. It's always going to be degrees of whatever. And, certain technologies will be on a certain way, while others can be delivered, like cloning, for example. But I don't know. We'll have to see. Right, let's get off this article and move somewhere else.
Right, I don't think we should do the rest. I think we should do a couple more maybe and call it a night. Just to say, we're recording this on the evening of Wednesday, the 7th of March, for those who keep track of these things. Where should we go next, Dar? What tickles your fancy?
I put a link here about 15 myths about memory and learning, which was published in February, also a week or so ago, by the Research Schools Network.
Oh, great.
We've just done a list one, but this is short and to the point, these 15 myths. So should we bang through those? I think they're fun.
Oh, interesting. So one is, we only use 10% of our brain. And I've just been reading a book, I'm still reading a book called Rest, by a guy called Alex Pang. Have you seen that?
I've not seen
it. It's really good. And he was featured on the Hurry Slowly podcast, which I think might be talking about in a moment. And he was saying how neuroscientists have actually found that even when we're resting, our brain activity only goes down a very small amount. So we actually are using all of our brain most of the time for lots of things.
Cool. Well, there we go. And that's what this one says. So in this article, there are links. You can go through to each one of the myths and go to the research that backs it up. But obviously, in true clickbaity way, I haven't done that. I've just assumed they're being all right.
Well, when you hover over the links and see where they are, the websites like scientificamerican.com, The Guardian, etc. So they're reputable sources.
Yes. So obviously, it's all fine. We hovered over the links, people. We are really, really checked out our sources. I think it's fine. Myth number two: we are more likely to remember something if we discover it for ourselves. Well, this is a wonderful common sense kind of thing, isn't it? But the evidence says that novice learners learn better through explicit teacher-led instruction rather than through discovering something on their own. My experience as a teacher agrees with this completely. Learners. So I don't have any problem with that.
It's about scaffolding, isn't it? I wouldn't necessarily say that teacher-led instruction is the cure, but I'd certainly say that appropriate scaffolding for novices, yeah.
Novice learners. So I think, I think it lends itself to the idea of the same thing that is it Daniel Willingham, possibly someone like that, does about reading. So if you take about visual audio kinesthetic learning styles, and if you take when the experiment that he did about baseball that we've talked about before. So you take baseball players and you read to them a baseball match, and then you give them a board and characters to play the players, and they will recreate the match in detail. But the same story is read to people who are just really good at being auditory learners, as in just learning through that methodology, apparently, and they weren't as good as the people who had done it. So, but my point.
Well, I just like to take a step back, actually, and just think, why has this person written this article?
Who is it? Andy Tharby.
Because I get the feeling that research schools are pretty conservative organizations, actually. And this seems to be supporting the whole thing, when you look through it, seems to be supporting a very traditional style of teaching.
Well, let's bang through them and then discuss it at the end, yeah? Okay, so...
Yeah, okay. Number three, men and women learn differently.
Okay, number four, we learn better when teaching is tailored towards our preferred learning style. That's a myth, yeah, fair play. Fifth.
Number five, your brain is a muscle that can be trained.
Yeah, these are myths, remember, they're not real. Number six, we do not need to remember facts, now we have the internet.
Number seven, myth seven, performance is always a sign of learning.
Myth eight, rereading notes and highlighting are effective revision strategies.
Number nine, we are good judges of how much we will remember.
Number 10, forgetting is the enemy of memory.
Myth 11, memorable lessons should always contain unique and unexpected experiences.
Myth 12, stories are only for English lessons.
Myth 13, learning is visible.
Myth 14, cramming is an effective revision strategy.
And myth 15, we can always trust our memory.
Okay, so at A Tharby, A-T-H-A-R-B-Y, on Twitter, has written this article. He has David Christelou, Daniel Williams, Robin McPherson, Shutton Trust, other things, looking at the research here. So EEF's on there. So what do you think? Do you think it is something that's just supporting what we might call traditional teaching methods?
There's some stuff in here. So what I think he's done, and I'm not entirely sure he's doing this deliberately. He's preventing, there's a whole swathe of myths, educational myths and things that you could present on here.
Mm-hmm.
And he has selected these particular 15, I would say, to
support,
to back up his view of how teaching and learning should take place, in the same way that you or I, Di, would do exactly the same thing if we did 15. Yeah. So some of these, I'd be like, yeah, absolutely. But some of them, well, I wouldn't disagree with them, but at the same time, why are you presenting those particular ones? So, for example, where is it? Memorable lessons should always contain unique and unexpected. If I just read the ones that I think really stand out to me.
Yeah.
So we are more likely to remember something if we discover it for ourselves. Myth. Men and women learn differently. Myth. We learn better when teaching is tailored towards our preferred learning style. Myth. We do not need to remember facts now we have the internet. Memorable lessons should always contain unique and unexpected experiences. Learning is visible. If we just take those ones, which are more than half of them, they all support, well, what we need is a teacher at the front teaching people, and we don't need to differentiate our instruction because everyone learns the same way. So just get on and learn some stuff. And if we can't see that learning, then it doesn't matter. It still goes in.
Yeah, and then forget about it so you can recall it, and that process actually facilitates learning because it reinforces retrieval, sort of thing, the desirable difficulty.
And then unsurprisingly, I go into his Twitter feed, and I didn't know this beforehand, but it's part of Tom Bennett's Research Ed Network. Well, there we go. Okay. And I'm not saying that I just want to stereotype people in terms of whatever, but like for me, if you're part of the Research Ed Network, you've pretty much just given away your entire view of what education should be about. End of story.
Yeah, no, I have that impression too. I think there's some of them I like, the 10% of the brain one, the brain training one, I kind of agree with. But then the one about reading, I don't agree with. I know people who have passed exams based on reading alone and not, reading and highlighting. But they're just reading, really not highlighting. But as effective revision, and got full marks in A-level exams through that method. So yeah, I wouldn't say that's the case. I do support the idea that synapses increase with repetition. I think that's right, and revisiting information is important.
There's also the fact that he's linking to one article here as if like, well, this is proved, boom, that's proved, boom, as if like none of these are contentious issues.
Yes, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? So, I mean, we have had an upsurge of these in the last 5 years or so, of researchers in schools and researching into education and all of that. And this site is evidence of that, and as is Tom Bennett's network, I guess, of research ed. And it all seems very, very simple to people who've gone and done it, et cetera, et cetera. And I always think, I mean, my position on sort of traditional versus progressive is that they both work. That's my understanding of it. And there's great degrees of separation in the delivery of within each of those ends of the spectrum. And I would always try and use a combination of both, I think, in my teaching. That's what I sort of aim to do is I encourage people to go and find things out for themselves, but I do it from a platform that I consider that I have helped them prepare. And of teacher-led instruction, I guess. So I don't do either one or the other. I see them as sets of tools that are available to me as I see fit.
And let me just pick out myth six. We do not need to remember facts now we have the internet. All right, so that's a myth. All right, so but his response is, good readers need wide-ranging general knowledge to successfully access, interpret, and determine the validity of online reading material. The internet offers a wealth of opportunity, but only for those who know a lot in the first place. So yeah, absolutely, you have to have an amount of knowledge to decide like where to start, etc. But there's never any mention, especially in research ed stuff, of the skills that are involved. It's always knowledge, never kind of the skill of figuring out whether that just doesn't look legit. Now then, I put something on my Thought Travel blog today, which I've actually just put in the show notes about, it's an Aon article, and I've just called it, Is Your Smartphone a Very Real Part of Who You Are? And we've talked about this before, I think, Di, about how you can outsource some of the things that previously you'd have to remember to your smartphone because it's just always there with you. And the article is fascinating because it talks about a case where there was a gunman who went into a church and shot everyone. And then police came along and got the corpse's finger from the gunman and unlocked his phone. And some people have said that that's a violation of different amendments or whatever, and that actually a smartphone should be considered part of the dead person's remains. that's how close it is in terms of their identity. Right. And I feel like, especially with this conceptualization, like this is just indicative. This article in terms of 15 myths around memory is indicative of a wider mindset about how education and society should proceed. And I feel like it doesn't kind of deal with the understanding that the world is changing. Like, I don't have to remember so many things anymore because I can go and find them real easily. I search, for goodness sake, for my own articles. I don't just remember that they're all there. I don't remember all of the dates in history. I don't need to. What's the point? I just understand how it all fits together.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's a crass myth, and I don't know anybody who thinks that.
No, indeed.
I've been teaching for a long time. I don't know anybody who thinks that. So that's an interesting way to look at it. We only use 10% of our brain. I've heard people talk about the idea of the unconscious. And for example, when you learn to ride a bike, when it all becomes so easy and you stop thinking about it, that's because the unconscious is driving it, and the unconscious is not the 10% of the brain. That's the rest of the brain getting on with their business. Myth two, we're more likely if we discover something for ourselves. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think if you discover something together, I think that's an interesting way of remembering something because you associate it with a relationship, and I think that has some potency maybe.
I'm pretty sure that if you learn, it depends what it is that you're learning too. I'm pretty much sure that if you are burned by fire, I'm pretty sure that you're more likely to remember that if you discover it by yourself. Also, if you're standing on the side of a pool and you're teaching me how to swim, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to remember how to do it better if I just jump in and start swimming.
Yes, I think that's a fair shout if you're looking at it in that regard.
So this is always knowledge-based stuff is my point. It's never vocational stuff.
I think so. Yeah, they're knowledge-based stuff. Yeah. Men and women learn differently. I don't think they do particularly. I don't think that ever influences anything to do with what I do. We learn better when teaching is tailored towards our preferred learning style. I don't believe that. I believe that that's not a thing. I do believe people have different learning styles, though, but I believe everybody has different learning styles about different topics, depending on who you are, where you are, and what's going on. I think it's contextual. I just don't think that anybody is one of the learning styles, preferably. sort of thing. I agree with that, that it is a myth that the brain is a muscle that can't be trained. Myth six, we do not need to remember facts that we know we have on the internet. I completely so we had a really interesting conversation last week about following instructions on YouTube. Do you remember? About washing machines and things like that. And Ben as well doing something or other. And how you do things. And I do know now how to fix a dishwasher, any dishwasher. And probably not all of it. Not every possible fault, but quite a lot of them. But certainly if someone asked me to fix a dishwasher, I would have I'd have a level of expertise or experience is a better word to draw upon and some knowledge surrounding that and the internet gave me those things but I don't need to remember all of it because I could go back to the internet and I know that I could, but it doesn't stop me knowing stuff kind of thing. It's a bit weird, so I don't know anybody who thinks that particularly. Performance is always a sign of learning. Everyone knows that's rubbish. I think, don't they? Is that really a myth? Because everyone thinks that. Does anyone think that? No. I don't think that. I know loads of people who just say 2 years after an exam that they don't remember anything from that exam. There's no learning has gone on.
That's just good. What you've just described there in terms of learning for the exam, then forgetting it so that you can get on with other stuff is just acing exams, isn't it? But exams are not a good way of measuring what we know.
I have this. I discussed my fourth form year 10s this week about they're done. A lot of them are done quite poorly in a test or sort of 50% or below. And when I thought about that, I was discussing it that with them about their learning processes and how secure their learning processes are. And this whole myth that you've got bright people who are just really good at this. And I say this is because their learning processes have been secure from a young age, and that's just the way their lives turned out. So you might think about them A, B, C, whatever. But these are your learning processes. So we discussed them and talked about them. What are you actively doing about these things to go out and make this happen? Because you are in competition for these qualifications. So I don't try and hide from that in my classroom. You're there for this thing. Do you want this qualification? Well, then you have to be better than 5,000 other people if you want it at this grade or above. And blah, 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 blah. So... you know, that kind of thing. And just about people being conscious of getting on and doing some work, I think. And yeah, but anyway, let's get off our myths. What else is there on?
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to put a link. It's kind of, we haven't got time to talk about it right now, but Seth Godin has a new podcast called Akimbo. And I was listening as I went for a run today. I was listening to episode 3, which is entitled I See You. No more square tomatoes. And he's talking about all kinds of stuff, including schooling. And he's talking about how different learning is from schooling he talks about industrial age machinery in schooling, but in a different way than I've heard people talk about before, and, you know, conforming to the system and all that kind of thing, and what the system rewards, and competitive sports in schools. And it's interesting, listen. I'd be interested to see what you and other people make of it. And also, I really like the way that he encourages, right from the first episode, he's encouraged people to provide audio feedback, which he then uses as questions on the previous episode that he then goes and chooses and answers. It's quite nice.
Oh, okay. So that's just, hang on, all I've got here, I can't see a video stream. I'm sorry, an audio stream. I've just got two videos. Sawabona and Regression to the Mean.
That's the show notes, I guess. Maybe I'm linking to the wrong thing.
All right, okay. Right, let's wrap this up. So what are you doing this week?
What am I doing this week? Well, this has been a five-day week for me for Moodle because I had a day off due to jet lag last week. I can hear you.
It's got a delay on it. Our audio is out of step.
I see. Okay, well, let's wrap it up there. This bit of audio might record, it might not. Sounds like Dianai's audio has gone out of sync with Zencastr, which is really annoying because it's what they said they'd fixed. But never mind. Sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.